Welcome to Curmudgeon's Corner. It is Wednesday, March 26th, 2014. It's around 2:30 UTC as we're recording this. I'm Sam Minter. Yvonne Bo is here again. Hello, Yvonne.
Yo, hello, hello.
We've got an exciting show planned for you as usual, but first I just wanted to mention, Yvonne, I know you tweeted this, but just to confirm, you're a billionaire right now, right? You won the Buffett bracket thing, or you're still in the running or something?
No, I'm out. And as a matter of fact,
everybody's out.
Everybody's out.
Yes.
But 90% of the people were out after the first game.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Because University of Dayton happened to beat Ohio State, and it was a huge upset, okay? And so 90% of the people basically got knocked out after the first game. So, yeah, we couldn't even make it past the first game.
So Buffett made a pretty good bet here.
Yes, he did. Yes, he did. Obviously. Well, that's why he's the second or third richest person in the world, and I'm not.
Yeah, there you go.
Okay, all right. You know, he's very astute about this stuff. So, yeah, we didn't make it. I mean, fuck, we didn't even make it out of the damn first game, for God's sakes. I mean, come on. Actually, I was doing relatively good on the bracket percentage-wise. If you went later on, I mean, I was like 14 out of 6. I was 13 out of 16 or something, but damn it. I mean, I got knocked down in the first game.
There you go. Anyway, we're going to, of course, there have been further developments on the missing Malaysian plane, although still haven't found it. There have been developments in the Ukraine.
It's together with those Bitcoins they found.
Yeah, because also this week, Mt. Gox found 200,000 of their missing Bitcoins.
Yeah.
It's just laying around somewhere.
Yeah, just, about $100 million. I mean, what's $100 million amongst friends anyway? I mean, really.
Yeah, I mean, it makes me think I should maybe look under the cushions in my sofa.
Maybe you find a few Bitcoins. Yeah.
Yeah. You never know.
Never know. Maybe
there was that family in California last month who was digging around in their backyard and found like a couple million in gold coins.
Yes, it was.
So you never know.
Yes, there was. Well, there was this other guy last week also who, what the heck was it? Bought a Fabergé egg apparently in some kind of like ridiculous like. Some auction.
It was at a yard sale for $20 or something.
Yeah. Yeah, it's only worth $15-20 million. So I guess things like that do happen. And, the guy bought it and didn't realize that he had it for years.
Yeah.
And then,
went on Antiques Roadshow and.
No. He went and he saw the name on the. It was a clock. Okay.
Yeah.
And he saw the name on it and he thought, I've read that might be expensive. And then he went and Googled it and then he realized, holy smoke, what the heck? And I don't know, he contacted an art dealer. No, he didn't. He contacted an art dealer and they validated that it was, an egg that hadn't been seen in over 100 years. Okay.
Nice.
Apparently. Since like 1902, and that it was authentic and it was sold. And, guessing that the last one at public auction sold for $15 million, I'm sure that the guy made quite a nice payday on his excursion. So I guess I should go more to yard sales, I guess.
You should go more to yard sales and pick up random crap. And,
yep.
Every once in a while, you'll get lucky. Although I'm not sure that's the best strategy in the world, unless you know what you're looking for.
Well, the guy thought it was worth something. He actually he paid like $10,000 for it.
Oh, okay, so he didn't pick it up for like $20 or something.
He paid a decent amount. It was valuable, and he paid like $10,000 for it, as far as I understood. So
it's still a good deal.
I mean, still, anyway, $10,000 for $15 million, still quite a bargain.
Yeah. But again, I don't think, if I just started wandering around yard sales picking up stuff, I'd just end up with an even bigger garage full of crap than I have already.
Right.
Yeah, because I don't know what to look for, because in order for that to be a winning strategy, you have to have at least some idea. like what you're looking for that might have some value.
True.
Or just get extremely
lucky. Well, I don't think this guy really had any clue. I mean,
he
this
just
guy
thought it looked cool enough to pay $10,000.
And it was gold, and he validated that it was made out of gold, so therefore, you know, that's why he paid the money he thought. As a matter of fact, a couple of times he thought about melting it and selling it for the gold. Okay, all right, imagine that. That would have been probably the worst deal on earth.
Of course, the worst deal would be do that and then find out what you had.
Right. Apparently, he had a couple of deals to do that, and they fell through. And then somehow then his brain clicked, and, you know, I mean, because he would have been kicking himself for the rest of his life if he found out later that he melted a $15 million item into nothing. That would have really sucked. But anyway.
Anyway, we're going to talk about the plane. We're going to talk about the Ukraine. Or is it just Ukraine? I hear there's a dispute on that, and it actually has some political significance whether you say the Ukraine or Ukraine. But I haven't read enough to realize what the difference is.
I have tried to find out. Or is it Ukraine or Ukraine?
No, it's the Ukraine versus Ukraine.
So, but wait, still haven't analyzed. So is it the Ukraine or the Ukraine?
See, that sounds the same to me. I don't know.
Anyway, all right. Let's move on.
We're going to talk about Obama saying that he's willing to change the NSA bulk surveillance laws at this point. And we are going to talk a little bit about the landslide that happened here close to where I am. You know, there's miscellaneous other stuff going on, but that's more than a full show right there. So let's get at it. Where do you want to start, Yvonne?
I don't know. Pick a number from 1 through 5.
You know, when you ask me this, I have to do it properly.
Oh, boy. You're going to use a random number generator. Boy, jeez.
Yeah, well, so I've got two choices. I've got...
Pick a number. No, I'll make it... No, pick a number 1 through 3 only. All right? There we go.
Okay. 2.
Okay, so we're going to talk about the Ukraine.
The Ukraine. Okay.
Yep.
So, as expected, since we last spoke, the Ukraine was officially annexed by Russia. Mm-hmm. And nobody in the West could stop this in any way, of course. But the number of sanctions and things that are going on have been sort of slowly increasing over the week. And I guess the question is, you know, A, how painful can we really make it? And B, does it make a damn bit of difference anyway? And
can we make it painful?
And one more, you know, and also, is there any real chance of Putin continuing on and picking off a few other pieces of eastern Ukraine? He's massing all kinds of troops there. And if there is a chance, does anything we do make any difference, or is he just going to do whatever the hell he wants to do anyway?
Okay. Look, I think that he may try to grab other bits and pieces. Okay, all right. But I will say this. If we really want to put the hammer on the Russians, we really can. And it doesn't have to be war. Okay, all right. One of the things that I realized the last week is, you know, all of a sudden somebody said, well, you know what? We're shutting down Visa and MasterCard shut down 4 Russian banks. Mm-hmm. All right.
What, was it all Russian banks or just one bank?
No, four banks. Specifically. Okay. One bank got completely cut off. They got cut off from SWIFT. They got cut off from everything. They can't do a freaking money transaction with anybody, period. Okay? Three other banks, including that one, were basically cut off from Visa and MasterCard, which, let's face it, everybody's around the world, debit and credit cards run through that. So basically, if you had all of a sudden your debit cards or anything, whatever, from these banks, you're basically, they're useless, okay? There's a lot of things like that. The Russians are not, this is not the Soviet Union of the 80s, that they were completely isolated, okay?
Right.
The Russians are interconnected with the rest of the world, okay, economy, okay? If the Russians think that they can just go and do stuff and that we have no measures that we can do, which can make it quite painful on them, it's going to become quite obvious
Let me ask
relatively quickly
When we talked about this a week or two ago, we said that, yes, there are things that can be done here, but especially the Europeans don't want to because it would negatively impact them as well.
I think the Europeans are starting to, at first they were like reluctant, but now the more they've seen, the more that they're seeing what the heck is going on, I think they're starting to come around to the fact, you know what, we have to put the hammer on the Russians. The hell with this. Okay? Because, you know, and it's not going to be militarily, you know, they... Let's face it, they enjoy spending quite a lot of time in Europe, all these guys, apparently except Putin, okay? They like going around. I mean, and if you really start cutting them off to all their goodies, I don't know what the hell they're planning on doing. Like I said, it was hilarious. You know, they banned like 7 Americans or whatever from going over there. McCain and all the people. And I'm like, really? Who gives a fuck? Really? So I can't – what? So, oh, my God. Yeah, you know, it was funny. McCain actually was funny and said, well, I'm going to have to cancel that vacation to Siberia, and I guess I won't be accessing any of those rubles I got. But the reality is, you put an oligarch and you say, you know what, you can't travel anywhere outside. You can't travel to Europe. You can't travel anywhere. You can't touch any of your money in your Swiss bank accounts or anywhere. That hurts. Because that's where all these guys are stashing their money.
So let's go to the next step. Okay, you can make it hurt. Is it going to make any difference to anybody's behavior? Is Putin going to suddenly decide, oh, you know, you're right, I screwed up?
Well, let me put it to you this way. I don't know if he's going to go and do that, but I got to tell you something, all right? He doesn't have unlimited money, all right?
Right.
The Russian economy has been weak, is weak and has been weakening over the last number of years. Can he go and, like, saber-rattle for a while? But, you know, at some point, you know what? You need money to do all this shit. And at some point, you know, the spigot, you know, if he starts doing that, the spigot's going dry. So I don't know how much of this shit does he think that he can really get away with. His army is not as strong as it used to be. Maybe he can push over like something like Crimea or something. But what the hell else does he plan on doing? What? What does he think he's invading? I heard something of stuff about Kyrgyzstan and Turkmenistan and massing troops into Ukraine and whatever. You know, listen, you remember the whole Chechen campaign? Them trying to take over Chechnya, like really suppress them? Listen, that cost them quite a lot of bloodshed and money to do. And Chechnya is nowhere nearly as big as a Ukraine.
Well, and they've still got, you know, terrorist issues going on right now that are...
Related to that.
Related to that, yes.
Yeah. So I really honestly think this whole thing had to do with Putin seeming weak because of what happened with the president of Ukraine. And he had to show strength in some way so politically he could show that he was strong to his people.
Because this was a matter of, you know, he was losing Ukraine.
That's exactly, yeah,
effectively.
Right. And not just that. He had put a bear hug on the Ukraine. He'd given all this stuff, and they were still going away anyway.
And one of the things is, you know, for the people who are going, oh, no, we lost Crimea, we lost Crimea, we lost Crimea. You know, another way to look at it is, hey, you just got the rest of Ukraine.
Right.
You know, or rest of Ukraine minus whatever else Putin chops off before he's done here. You right. Still, whatever is left of Ukraine is going to be more solidly with the West than it ever was before.
That's exactly right.
And this part of Ukraine, well, you didn't want to go that way anyway.
You know? I mean, we know that the referendum was a joke and it was stacked. But still, look, even if you've held it as a free and fair election, it probably still would have passed. Anyway, all right.
It would have been a lot closer, but it would have passed.
It would have passed. Okay, so that's the reality about that piece. But I just, you know, I really think
probably less true of the other parts that we're talking about. Maybe chopping off because they're
right.
They're in the like Crimea was the only place that had an actual Russian speaking majority. The other places are have heavy Russian minorities, but not majorities.
Right.
And that's not necessarily to say that votes on this kind of thing would go strictly on ethnic lines, but yeah, kind of. So.
But for the most part, they probably would. But anyway, you know, I think that I really think that, especially a lot of the people that are around him, that they're able to talk to him, you know, despite all his, you know, BS that he's saying, look, Vlad, okay, let me just tell you something, okay? You may not be taking this shit seriously, but let me tell you something. If we keep pushing, I mean, this is just a little sample of the shit that they did financially. They could really fuck with us badly, and we can't do the same to them. They have, the Russian economy is Brazil's bigger freaking economy than Russia, for God's sakes. I mean, come on. It's a joke. I mean, they can't do shit. I mean, yeah, so they'll jack up the price of oil or gas or whatever for a little big deal. Big fucking deal. I mean, they're going to bring us down to our knees because they're not exporting oil? Bullshit. They're bringing them, they'll kill themselves first by doing that. So.
And as a number of people have pointed out, theoretically, the U.S. could loosen export controls and we could start filling some of that gap if we really wanted to.
And not just that.
Although it takes some time.
But the thing is that the Strategic Petroleum Reserve right now is so full of oil, for God's sakes. Whatever the hell Russia did, the Russians don't want to put any more in the open market, fine. We'll probably fill that gap for a couple of years with the oil in that. And they'd be having no money, and we'd be getting the money. So what can they do to counter that? They've got nothing. So at this point.
So I want to get back to like the actual like, is this all? I mean, okay, you've made a good case that we could actually hurt them in a way that they'd feel it, but like, what difference is it actually going to make to what Putin actually does? Is it actually going to deter him from jack shit, or is he going to do what he was going to do anyway? And then
I think he did what he felt he needed to do.
Or did he already do what he was going to do? In which case,
I think he did at this point what he felt he needed to do, and he wanted to test to see what the reaction was. Okay, all right.
Because you thought if there was no reaction, he'd go ahead and grab
maybe
more
do more.
And
yeah.
You think now he's not going to? And
I think he's thinking about it. Because here's the thing. I mean, like I said before, anything that you want to do on a massive scale, say like Ukraine. Ukraine's got a population of, how big is it? I mean, I can't remember. I'm looking it up right now. But occupying any country is expensive. 45 million people, for God's sakes. Dude. They don't have the resources to occupy a country that big. They don't. I mean, they just don't. So,
although again, you don't necessarily have to occupy the whole thing. You have to destabilize it in such a way that the existing government, which is very weak and temporary right now, falls, and you can put one of your guys back in charge again.
But even still, that was part of why the riots were out on the streets. Why the guy had to go and leave the country. So how is that going to do anything?
Right. The question is, like, at this point, I think that it may be too late for that kind of stuff, because one of the things that happens after these sort of popular revolutions is the people realize they have some power to change things. I mean, this is not even the first one in Ukraine. If you remember, was it the Orange Revolution a few years back?
Right, right, right.
Yeah. So the people have basically recognized that if they don't like what they're going on, throw a fit, it'll change.
Right.
You know, so it's, by the way, completely unclear that the people who are now in charge in Ukraine are actually all that wonderful to begin with. Mm-hmm. There might be a lot of corruption and other stuff going on there, but it's a new group of people. And I don't know. I'm not as optimistic as you are that any of this stuff that we're doing actually changes anything on the ground at all. I mean, I know it's good for the optics, but
I actually think there's more effect to it than you actually see. I actually think the total opposite. It's not about optics. I don't think it has a lot of optics. I don't think most people are paying attention to the stuff.
Well,
again,
because like, you know, if you listen to the folks on the right, they're still jumping up and screaming that we're not doing anything.
Right. And I think that because these things are actually, that's the total opposite. These things don't have a lot of optics. These are things that actually, if you are somebody, look, like one of the things we're talking about right now. Russia has a stock market right now, right? Unlike like 20, 30 years ago. Guess what? The Russian stock market is getting hammered, okay? The ruble has gotten pounded, okay? The ruble's down 30%, and the Russian stock market is getting hammered, okay? All right? And these are all the people that put the money to help frickin' Putin do all his bullshit, okay? All right? But you don't think that adds to, you don't think that puts pressure on him?
I'm sure it does.
All he wants.
But let's see, like, sanctions have a history here. You know, we had sanctions on South Africa for how many years before there was political change there? We've had sanctions on Iran for how many years, and we still don't have the desired behavior there? You know, sanctions are...
Yeah, but here's the thing. When you talk about those two places, right?
Yeah.
Okay, like Iran... Or South Africa.
Yep. And there are other places. Yeah. Okay, North Korea, blah, blah, blah.
Look, Cuba and Iran were never fully integrated into the rest of the world economy, nor were they all of a sudden, you know, as wealthy as the Russians have become in the last 20 years. Okay. So it's a different thing of like, for example, look, if I went and I put a sanction on Washington State where nobody could use their Visa or MasterCard debit cards, how much would that hurt now?
Yeah, I'd be having trouble eating within the next 24 hours.
My point exactly. If you put that sanction on Cuba or Iran right now, does that really make a fucking difference on the average person? No. And that's the thing about this, okay? Sanctions have different effects depending on what you use, depending on who you use it, okay? All right?
And also how leaky or not they are.
Exactly.
Many of those I just listed were very leaky sanctions regimes where some countries were participating, others were not. There were plenty of ways around them.
Right. So that's one thing.
Not all of them. They a variety, but you know what I mean.
Yeah, so that's the one thing I see. I mean, it just, you know, the thing with sanctions, it just really depends on what you're interested in and what you want. I mean, it's kind of tough. If you're North Korea, you don't have shit. What the hell do I get with, like, cutting off your Visa and MasterCard? Nothing. you don't have lights, for God's sakes. You know?
But this is another thing here, too, which is, you know, how much do you go after hurting, like, you know, the top 100 oligarchs versus things that hurt the economy of the country as a whole. And how do you,
depending on what they do, I think the whole point of doing these sanctions to a certain extent was to show Putin that we could do stuff that hurts. Okay. Right. All right. People, I'm sure, already told him that it hurt. Okay. All right. So the question that Putin's got right now in front of him is, hey, do I want to keep doing shit? Because if I do, you already seen you already saw a sample of what the bill is.
So your take here is everything that's happened so far is basically a warning shot.
Yes, absolutely. That's why we didn't go and cut off SWIFT or cut off every bank from Visa and MasterCard in Russia. There's only a few and only a few people. Now, you want to really get into it? I mean, this is just a sample of what can happen. You're the one that decided to be fully integrated with the Western world, not ours, and now you want to play by different rules. Well, you know, it doesn't work. It doesn't work that way. So
do you think folks are? I mean, how weak do you think Putin really is? Do you think if they crank the screws a little here, suddenly Putin's out?
No, I don't think Putin is falling anytime soon. I mean, I think this has strengthened him short term with a lot of people that he wanted to be strengthened with. Look, I mean, let's put it to you this way. The changes, political change in Russia in the last, I don't know how long, has not come all that peaceably, really.
Right.
Think about it. I mean, Putin is a guy who has a lot of popularity, but I'm sure I know has been pissing off a lot of people too. Okay, and you know how things are. I mean, I don't know why a whole bunch of these oligarchs don't get pissed off, and I don't know for some reason decide to put a bullet in his head. You know, well, I mean, it's not like it hasn't happened before. You know, they used to make the joke of a Soviet suicide. You know, you ever heard your joke of Soviet suicide?
Yeah,
two bullets to the head. Well, you know, hey, they don't call it that for nothing, all right? I mean, I don't know.
So I'll tell you, just backing up a little bit. I mean, last week and the week before, you know, I said a number of times, if I wasn't worried about us not doing enough, like a lot of people on the right were, I was more worried that we were doing too much. But, you know, I think over the last week and even more so, I think you're convincing me on some of your arguments here. But over the last week as well, just as these things have slowly add this piece slowly, right, but surely, I'm starting to think, you know, maybe Obama has it just right here.
I think he does at this point.
And that this is one of those, you know, as Andrew Sullivan calls it, a meep meep moment, you know, like the Roadrunner and the Coyote.
Yeah.
Where, you know, Obama's getting criticized from left, right, center, everywhere for not doing it right. And then as the time progresses, all of a sudden the pieces start falling into place of like, oh,
that's what we're doing.
That's what we're doing. That kind of makes sense. And we're getting a good result in the end that makes us happy.
We didn't go bomb anybody
without bombing anybody and without starting a war. And, you know, and maybe we don't get everything we want, but we got a decent result. I mean, like, you could argue over Syria, you know, like, okay, we got the deal to eliminate the chemical weapons and blah, blah, blah. And of course, since then is like, you know, have they really eliminated anything? Are they hemorrhaging and hawing? Are they hiding stuff? Blah, blah, blah. And of course, the war there has continued and people are still dying every day. But, you know, we didn't get involved. And, you know, I count that as a win.
I do too. But even like in the midst of all those announcements, at one point, I think, who was it? Was it Putin or somebody from Russia? I remember it. I heard said, well, we're going to stop this tit for tat of sanctions. We don't want to be doing that. And I'm like, I don't know if that what kind of signal they were trying to send with that, because honestly, I mean, let's face it, the sanctions that they announced to the Western world were a joke. I mean, let's face it. Yeah, I mean, oh gosh, you know, please don't cancel my Russian visa. I mean, for God's sakes. I mean, but what the hell? I mean, I don't know. I don't know what they were, you know, it just seemed very weird that they said that. And I think that the only reason they would be trying to say that is for some reason is because, obviously, because they realized they didn't like what the hell was going on. That was my feeling when I heard that. So, and they were somehow, you know, trying to figure out how they could, you know, slip and slide into getting, you know, Western Europe and the U.S. to back off on some stuff, which at this point they haven't. So, I think that the moves that have been done to now have looked, you know, are the moves that are moves that I think are in the right direction. And we'll, you know, now we got to see how Russia reacts and where we go from here. And let's face it, if he...
Hey, but how will we ever know if there's no G8 meeting?
Yeah, whatever.
Okay, let's take a break, and we'll come back and switch to one of our other exciting topics. Back after this.
Information.
Okay, we're back.
All right.
Should I roll dice again? Should I roll dice?
Well,
I like rolling dice.
You pick the topic. Well, as you want to pick. Okay. Well, obviously, but of course, we have to eliminate the number. I don't know. So
what we have left? We have the plane, the landslide, and the NSA stuff.
All right. So go 1, 2, 3.
I pick 3.
We're going with the NSA.
NSA, yeah. And before we dive deep into NSA, I just want to mention in passing the thing with the Microsoft email. which was the Microsoft. There were reports in the press of insider information from Microsoft.
Yeah.
And obviously a leak from inside Microsoft. And there were lawsuits involved. There were things going on. There was a criminal investigation going on for, you know, corporate spying, espionage kind of stuff, whatever. But then Microsoft decided, hey, wait, this reporter who's publishing these stories about us has a Hotmail account. Let's just go look. And Hotmail is, of course, owned by Microsoft. Let's just go looking through his email and find out.
Here's a question I have. Does Microsoft have the right to do that according to their terms of service?
Yes, they absolutely do.
Well, then they're screwed. That's why you should use a fucking Hotmail account in the first place. the reporter's a fucking moron for having done that in the first place.
Well, look, here's a couple things here. Yes, that it was in the terms of services. Yes, if you read that, you should have been, if you were that reporter, you should have been thinking, Hotmail.
I'm writing these fucking stories about Microsoft. Maybe using a Microsoft account is not the best idea.
But, you know, Microsoft has gotten quite a bit of PR flack over this in the last week, and they have announced some changes to their policies, and they won't do this without a court order or something in the future or something or other. It of course, gives them all kinds of wiggle room still. But, you know, the difference is here, you know, if you are an employee of Microsoft, you expect, you know that your work email is not private in any way. It's owned by the company. Correct. But your assumption... And this is an incorrect, bad assumption, by the way. But the assumption most people have, if they have an email account with an email provider, is that the email is theirs and that the company is not going to go digging around in their email. But, yeah, it's a bad assumption. I mean, like, it's a best practice. Like, if you're an email provider, you're not going to be doing this willy-nilly. You're not going to have your employees reading random customers' email and laughing at it. You will fire those employees if they're caught doing that kind of stuff. But, you know, almost every single one of these, first of all, like, if you're, like, a Gmail or something, their entire business model relies on them being able to scan your email.
Right.
Exactly. Now, maybe it's not a human being doing it, but it relies on them scanning your email. And every single provider of services like this, if you read their terms and services, reserves the right to look at whatever they need to. If they need to for sort of technical reasons, if they need to troubleshoot, if they need to for any number of a dozen reasons or more, you know. So bottom line is, it is up to your service provider to decide when or if they will look into your stuff. And it's a question of trust. Do you trust them to really only do it when they absolutely have to or not? And so, you know, Microsoft took a trust hit on this. You know, but it's not a, there's no legal issue.
I agree, but there was no, but that was the one thing. I was like, I read it and I understood the part about the trust, but I mean, what I did understand also when I read it, I'm like, well, but I thought that they could. I mean, you know, so I guess I didn't, you know, think about it that much because maybe I'm just, you know, I guess I'm just know that, I mean, enough that I didn't assume that there was any privacy from that.
And look, this comes, and this is where it ties back into the NSA-related stuff, because the bottom line, email is not encrypted in any way, shape, or form unless you do it yourself. And so, therefore, you know, even if Microsoft wasn't looking at it, their email passes through any number of servers between the sender and the receiver. That's how it works. It bounces across the internet to get where it's going. At any single one of the points in between, it can potentially be intercepted. People can look at it. Not to mention, of course, the person who's receiving the email you send can hit a forward button and send it to anybody in the universe they want. Email is not secure communication. Period. End of story. You know, and any use of it that assumes privacy is fundamentally flawed. You know, unless you are going through the trouble to figure out how to do encryption on your email and use PGP or something, email's wide open. Email's an open book. You know, but it is an expectations thing. It's a trust thing. It's the same thing as, like, everybody knows that, you know, the lock on their front door most likely doesn't stop anybody from breaking in who really wants to break in, but you kind of, society has certain trust levels where you assume people are going to behave in a normal, rational way. I mean, same thing, just driving down the highway, all it takes is somebody swerving and kills everybody on the road.
True.
But, you know, you trust that people aren't going to do that.
Hope not.
You hope not.
Yeah.
Every once in a while they do. I mean, there's that thing at South by Southwest a couple weeks ago.
A drunk driver
plowed into a crowd. You know,
but, we had a couple of years ago, terrible incident. I mean, we had in the morning, for God's sakes, a drunk driver, I don't know, at 10 in the morning, went and plowed into a cycling event that we were having and killed a young child. You're like, really? You're fucking like stone drunk at 11 a.m. in the morning on a fucking Saturday? I mean, for real? Anyway,
moving on to NSA. The big announcement this week was Obama came out and said that he is going to support legislation to end the bulk surveillance practice on phone records. So if you remember, the very first thing that came out of the Snowden revelations, and it wasn't entirely brand new because some of this was revealed back in 2006 in a different context under George W. Bush, but that basically the government was on a routine basis collecting metadata about phone calls from all the major phone companies and maintaining a database going back years of every phone call made in the United States so that they could connect the dots on, you know, if they had a suspect of interest, find out everybody they called and everybody those people called and try to discern patterns and things like that. After months of defending this stuff, Obama said, okay, let's get rid of it. And we'll also not be requiring the telcos to retain this information any longer than they're already required by law. Now, I actually didn't realize that there's already an 18-month data retention requirement for the telcos. So they are already required to retain those records for 18 months regardless. Because I was thinking it would be a competitive advantage if you opened up a new, phone business, even if you were, whatever they call it, when you release the other people's lines so you don't have to run new wire, saying, I don't keep any records. You know, you pay a flat fee. Maybe I track overall minutes, but the second you're done with a phone call and I don't need it anymore, I trash the to and from information. You know, a company could actually compete based on that as a model, but apparently not. Apparently, there's an 18-month retention requirement anyway. But one of the things people were worried about was that they would take this out of the government, but effectively retain all the capabilities by simply saying requiring all the telcos to keep all this stuff for 5 years. They're not doing that. They're not extending that information. Essentially, they've determined that 18 months is probably good enough for most purposes. Even a lot of the folks like the EFF and the ACLU and Glenn Greenwald are saying, you know, this is a positive move. It's in the right direction. It vindicates Snowden, I've heard a number of them say. All of them have also said, though, the devil is in the details. We haven't seen the details yet, so let's wait.
And that's been my thing. I guess I read it, but since I've also heard the announcements, I was kind of like, well, let's see what the hell the details are about this.
Yeah,
and that was my thought.
Oh, and I've got barking and yelling again, and someone climbing on me.
That's always good.
So anyway, my take's the same take. Like, to me, My basic evaluation on a lot of these things is, first of all, yes, absolutely. Are you going to let me talk again, Alex?
Long pee. Wow poo. Oh.
Mommy's coming for you. Okay, Alex. Mommy's got you. Okay, so as I was saying, show me the details, but also, like, a lot of these things, unless I hear the intelligence community, like, going nuts about how this is a betrayal and how this will be horrible and it's giving away national security, I don't believe it actually makes a damn bit of difference.
Well, look, it depends who the heck we're talking about that's complaining, okay? Because I don't expect the actual real intelligence community to say anything.
Well,
okay?
No, look, here's what happens in these things. Nobody's going to say anything publicly.
Right.
You'll have leaks up the wazoo of, you know, an unidentified off-the-record person from the intelligence community saying blah, blah, blah.
Right.
You know, because, yes, the people who are actually, like, the head of the CIA is not going to publicly say a damn thing. They know who their boss is.
Right, right.
You know? But you believe me, you would hear about it if people were upset by these things. And, you know, and I've
heard... No, I hear you.
And I've heard... And, like, fundamentally, I think the more I hear about all these problems, the more I fundamentally think it's not just a little problem here or there. It's that there's been the fundamental assumption that certain behaviors are okay, and it's okay to keep certain things secret that are just, you know, going over the line, and the only way to fix it is to rip it all up, you know? And I at the same time, I hear people saying, you know, look, the Snowden revelations have caused all kinds of very serious damage to our intelligence capabilities. And I've even heard people pointing at Crimea specifically and saying, you know, we wouldn't have been surprised about this if it wasn't for Snowden.
Oh, bullshit. No, come on. You know, the fucking people. I mean, whatever. These are the same fucking people. You know, these are the same people gave us all that shitty intelligence on the fucking Soviet threat back in the 70s and 80s. These are the same fucking people that went and, like, told us that there was weapons of mass destruction in fucking Iraq, for God's sakes. Oh, come on. Don't get me started.
Well, let me even go a step further. Let me assume for a minute that they're actually correct. And there was some damage to U.S. intelligence capabilities, and that because of it, we lose a little bit of an advantage in negotiations or situational awareness or something.
Daddy, do you have your phone? Do you have your phone?
Do you want my phone? Will you go downstairs and take my phone?
Wait a second.
Okay, there, you can use my phone. Go.
Wait a second.
Oh, there you go. You'll never get your phone back.
Yeah. What am I waiting for?
Your phone's dead.
What are you trying to do? Oh, you want the flashlight. Okay. Okay, go, kids. Bye, Alex. He's examining something with the flashlight on the phone. I was saying, even if it does cause some damage, one of the fundamental differences here, I think, is that it's not just security versus... thank you, Alex. It's not just security versus freedom or anything like that, but it's are there principles at stake here that are important enough that even if it does damage our security a bit, it's worth it because the damage to our values as a country is more significant than whatever damage could happen by having a little bit less intelligence about what's going on in the world. You know, because as a society, we value the notions that people should feel secure in their information and belongings and the unreasonable search and seizure. We believe that, you know, you should have, there should be real individualized suspicion against somebody before you go after them or investigate into their details. And that these are sort of fundamental American values that, you know, there's a cost to losing those values that's equal to or greater than whatever you would lose in a security perspective from not having these capabilities. And I think that's part of what's at play here. I think that's part of the, you know,
I don't think this program really helped this shit.
Well, and all I'm saying is, even if it did help, I think there's a strong argument that we still shouldn't do it, because doing it is a fundamental compromise of American values that isn't worth it, even if it does make us a little bit safer. And I think you're right. There's a lot of evidence that it didn't really help that much. But even if it did help, I still think we shouldn't do it.
Well, not this way, no. That's for sure. So,
and of course, there've been a lot that the more recent revelations, and of course, this thing from Obama is very much specifically about this one program, not talking about everything else. A lot of the more recent revelations, it's been like, okay, so you're telling me the NSA is spying? Isn't that their job?
I know.
And you know, because there were revelations that they had infiltrated various, what's the name of the Chinese company?
Huawei.
I can never pronounce that, but you know.
I can never pronounce it. I'm not sure I even pronounced it right. But that's their job.
I mean, we've been
suspecting that they've been infiltrating American companies, Canadian companies, and all over. We've been trying to determine whether they have been.
But you know, I'll say, I understand that's their job, but I'm wondering if their job should be as expansive as it is, because even if you're talking completely foreigners, no Americans involved, I still fundamentally think, like, you know, your rights against unreasonable search and seizure should not be fundamentally different depending on whether you're American or not. These are fundamental human rights. They're not. I recognize they're guaranteed by the amendments of the Constitution legally in the U.S. and those don't apply elsewhere, but they're fundamental moral human rights. It's not just
but those rights are not
question.
Completely unfettered. It's not like I will say this. Maybe what you're looking for is more for a process in terms of us spying and have a legal authority to do that, because the reality is that there is legal authority for you to be searched, for you to be surveilled. You can go to court. You could do that. Those rights, as they're enshrined there, are not unlimited. Okay?
No, they're not unlimited. But I think a lot of this fundamentally comes from the assumption, well, you know, they weren't really protecting Americans all that much either, but there is a fundamental assumption in all of these intelligence activities that anybody who's not American gets a lot less consideration than people who are, and I fundamentally don't buy that in the end.
I mean, I understand the concern. I mean, I think there should be a due process no matter whether you're American or not. And you know, it shouldn't be just anybody could just go willy-nilly and just investigate.
And it should be individualized. Like, there was the report last week or whatever it was, that it was an unnamed, they didn't say which country, but there was at least one, perhaps more, countries where we were actually capturing 100% of the telephone calls, and not just metadata, the actual audio. 100%.
Yes, I did hear that, yes.
Now, it's probably Afghanistan or somewhere, and okay, right. You can understand why we might want to do that, but still, it's like, really? You're recording 100% of the calls in some country? You know, I don't care if it is.
Just that if there was a way for me to get the legal authority to do that, given the situation there, I would. I mean, me.
You personally. You'd like to have that at your fingertips.
No. If I were, okay, in a position, if I were in the military and I'm concerned about protecting protected troops, then yes, I would probably go and say, fuck it, can we capture them all? Yes. Can I get authority to do it?
I think that's an overreach, even if it's Iraq or Iran or Afghanistan. You're in war in the freaking country. I can see how people could want it. I can see how people could want access to every call in the whole world all the time for every I can see why you would want this stuff, but that's the reason we have checks and balances, because, you know, the same thing. Yeah, the police don't want to do Miranda. The police don't want rules of evidence. The police don't want any of this stuff. We do it anyway because that's required to be fair.
But you're mixing ones where we have actually enshrined constitutional protections versus we're talking about people where we don't have any written. Okay.
What I'm fundamentally saying is that there's a different issue. There's the legal questions And then there's the moral and ethical issues. And I think from a moral and ethical perspective, there is no legitimate reason that lets you say, you know, if they're at home in Indiana, if it's an American in Indiana, we would have to treat them this way. But if it's a Yemeni in Afghanistan, all bets off.
Well, but that goes back to what I said. There should be a due process whether you're in the U.S. or not. Just because it's not enshrined in the Constitution doesn't mean that we couldn't come up with one.
Right, right, yeah. No. I think we're in violent agreement here. But anyway, and the one other thing I just want to mention on NSA stuff before moving on. There have been a couple people on Twitter, and there was one specifically, Joshua Faust, I think is his name. I could be getting that a little bit wrong, but who were going on and on about, you know, and this has been a recurring theme amongst certain people, that why are you worried about what the NSA has on you? You know, you should be much more worried about Experian. You should be much more worried about Google. These companies can really hurt you and may want to, like, your credit rating makes a hell of a lot more difference to you than whether the NSA has some phone metadata.
Sure.
And look, and the clear implication in these folks when they make these points are, you really shouldn't care about what's going on with NSA. It's no big deal. Whereas I think the right answer here is you should care about both of them. You know, yes, you should probably be a lot more concerned than you are about the corporate information that's out there and what various companies are keeping and doing with your information than a lot of people are right now. It doesn't mean you shouldn't be concerned about the NSA. It means you should be more concerned about the other crap.
Right.
Anyway.
Well, anyway.
Let's take another break.
Let's break it up.
We got the plane and the landslide still to go.
All right.
Taking a break. We'll be back after this. Okay, I'm getting ready to roll dice again. I'm going to roll a 20-sided die. If it is an even number, we will do the plane. If it's an odd number, we'll do the landslide.
All right.
Okay. Did you hear that? I should make sure it's loud. I always forget when I do this to put it in front of the microphone. So here we go. Okay, 14, even. And by the way, it was even the first time I did it too. So
okay.
So the plane. So
the plane, boss. The plane.
Yeah, I saw somebody on Twitter say, "Too bad Hervé Villechaize is dead. Otherwise, he'd be able to find the plane."
Yeah, that one's been overused. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Anyway, so the latest is basically they did some refinements from Intelsat, who's the ones who came up with those arcs in the first place that said at 8:11 p.m. the plane had to be on one of these two arcs based on the timing information from the satellite. They did some additional analysis of that, including looking at the Doppler effect of the signal coming into the satellite, and determined that it basically had to be on the southern arc. Combine that with the information on probable flight speed and flight time, and you end up with a much more constrained search zone in the South Indian Ocean, which is basically where they've been concentrating for the last week, and which, you know, I said a number of times, I think we talked in the last show, they know stuff they're not saying publicly. One of the things we saw in the last week is all of the search ended up, for the last week at least, prior to this announcement from Intelsat, they were already concentrating exclusively on a fairly narrow zone in the South Indian Ocean. I had mentioned last week and on Twitter, or even before that, that absent something strange like the theory somebody had of tailing the other plane, we'd had country after country after country on the northern arc saying, we would have detected it if something that size was flying through our airspace. We detected nothing. It's not here. And but now with this additional piece of evidence, even it seems like we're fairly solid now. It went south. It ended up in the Indian Ocean. Now it's just a matter of searching for it. They still haven't found the plane. They keep finding things to go looking for, but nothing's been confirmed as being from the plane yet. They haven't, for the most part, even been able to reproduce finding something that they try to look for. How does this change everything you were saying last week, or does it?
It doesn't at all. As a matter of fact, the editor of I think it was Flying Magazine, okay, which is a very experienced commercial pilot, basically wrote a note today. At least it was published today on CNN, basically pretty much saying that what I said was right. Okay, that. This mechanical, magical bullet scenario that people are trying to come up with based on what the aircraft is, it's just hocus. It's just bogus. It's just there. I mean, it basically it would have to be like the Kennedy, the single bullet.
So now the one thing, and I certainly get that point. The one counter thing that I want to mention on that, and I had a an SMS conversation with somebody about this a few days back. Mm-hmm. Here's the thing. At this point, airline travel is so damn safe. Mm-hmm. They've eliminated through trial and error after every accident, they fix or change something to make sure that thing doesn't happen again exactly the way it happened before.
Correct.
At this point, airline travel is so damn safe. It almost has to be a very strange combination of events or pilot error or intentional action in order for anything to happen.
I think that my conclusion, it had to be some kind of intentional action in some way. There is just no other real explanation. A couple of things, for example, that the guy from Flying Magazine confirmed, like I said. The whole thing about the altitude changes, like I said before, that data is always bogus. That plane, in order to have flown the distance it managed to fly, okay, the only way it could have done that if it had stayed steady at 35,000 feet. All right? There is no other way, number one. Second thing that a couple of people forgot, I had forgotten about this, even though I did know this fact. The whole thing about the fire with the cockpit is just such a bunch of bullshit, because one of the things that the plane's designed, that the cockpit is designed with positive pressure in that plane specifically because of previous fire incidents in other aircraft, which basically means that any gases from the outside cannot get to the damn cockpit. It doesn't matter if there's a fire in the cargo hold, there's a fire in the cabin or whatever. It doesn't matter. The fumes may overcome the passengers. They're not going to overcome the pilots. Okay.
So does that mean? So there are a couple things still possible here, right? I mean, one is, whoever it was, an intentional action. They decided, I'm going to fly into the Indian Ocean until I run out of gas. And they just flew the whole damn way there.
Yep.
The other is, some kind of decompression is still a possibility. Is that, but that wouldn't handle the communication.
The decompression is just doesn't make sense either. Because if the decompression had happened, okay, all right, it would have been detected. All they would have to do is go low. Just drop to the right altitude, and that is just another one. There was just have to be some kind of magic bullet scenario again of mechanical failures. Because if there was a decompression, okay, listen, decompressions have happened in other aircraft. They wouldn't have knocked out all these other things that didn't work at the same time either. A decompression doesn't explain it, okay, all right, either. Which is why it just keeps coming back to, you know, like I said, this guy wrote, I believe it's like, look, either it was an intentional act it was a failed hijack, or it was an intentional act that somehow left the cabin crew incapacitated for whatever way, or, you know, the guy just had the purpose to just fly the damn plane until it ran out of fuel and crash it. For whatever reason. So, it's just, that's what it just seems like.
So let me ask this. Do you think at this point, are they ever going to figure this one out? Or is this one they'll still be talking about in 40 years as we have no idea?
Well, look, the seas out there today were, Jesus, they were like 20 meters to 30 meters high.
Which is what, like 90 feet, right?
30 meters. Yeah, like 90 foot seas. It's insane. They had to call off the operations. They said that the weather might not improve over the next few months.
Right. Because it's starting to be winter, and this is an area of the ocean that is particularly known for
really hot, bad, right,
really bad, unnavigable seas.
Yeah, I mean 30 meter seas. I can't even fathom. Somebody sent me a video today of a very big ship going through like what looked like 40 to 50 foot seas. I mean, I was getting seasick just looking at the fucking video. For God's sakes, it was so bad. So there's no way search and rescue operations.
And let's say the scenario is, you know, pilot just flew south until it ran out. You know. Even if they find the black box, right, it only keeps like the last 90 minutes, right?
Keeps data keeps for a long time, okay? But audio only the last 2 hours,
right? But if you think like whatever critical events, right?
If they're silent for the last 2 hours until this thing just crashes, then
yeah, because like whether the crew was incapacitated or it was somebody intentionally doing this, if you have just silence. You don't gain anything from that. And if it was, I guess if they find the data part, then we'll be able to tell, was there some sort of mechanical issue?
And if we confirm that there was none, then, you know, it had to be an intentional act. Would we know
but
what
again,
the
But again, even if there was a mechanical issue, it had to have been a... Alex! It had to have been a mechanical issue that allowed them to continue flying for 6 hours.
Right. But there's just, that's the problem. Those just don't exist. You know, that's the problem. You know, they just don't exist. You know, so I don't know. Now, here's the thing about it. Like we were talking about, it becomes incredibly difficult if we can't at least identify where the hell the damn wreckage is.
Right.
To in the future find the damn black boxes, okay? I mean, we need to find that wreckage, and we need to find it soon. If we don't, the reason why with the Air France plane, they were able to find the black boxes later was because the wreckage was found, you know, in a few days after the accident. And so, therefore, it had an idea of what area to look. It took 2 years to retrieve them, but they were able to be retrieved. And, on that flight, look, I mean, everybody had all this speculation about that flight and stuff, and it wound up being a pilot error. Yeah. Totally. I mean, we were all, was it terrorism, was it this and that? When they pulled up, when they pulled all the data, the pilots just screwed up, handled incorrect speed indication in the cockpit and stalled the plane into the ocean. That's it.
So the
777 is a smarter plane than that plane. Tougher to do that. Than those pilots did. But I you know.
So, having said that, do you think... will there be, you know, there are lots of people talking about, okay, we need to just turn on automatic, you know, location tracking, pinging on all flights everywhere, but it's going to cost a lot. And, you know, hey, this is the first time this has happened ever. You know, is it worth spending a lot of money?
I think it is worth it because, you know, forget about, you know, you can't do this, but it does help with a lot of other stuff. Okay. All right. You know, just even maintenance, communications, and other things. I mean, it is convenient, okay? It's silly that it's not turned on. I mean, you know, here's the thing about the hardware.
As I say, we have the technology.
Well, it's not just that. This aircraft was equipped with the technology. They just didn't subscribe to the damn service.
Right.
Okay? You know? So it wasn't for, I mean, all they had to do was just turn the damn thing on. Like the guy mentioned, it costs about a dollar an hour, maybe. Okay. Mm-hmm. Right. To have the service running. That's it. So, but you know, I think that, you know, a couple of key things, the distance that the plane flew and where the area that they've narrowed down to where it is. It seems according to all that the plane remained at a cruising altitude, 35,000 feet. It really didn't deviate from that. And so that really brings, you know, narrows the possibilities of what went wrong with a plane. I mean, I'm sorry. There is just no, forget about the damn fire. There is no fire that all it was going to do was just disable the system, disable the pilots, and then leave the plane flying for 6 hours. It was a fire. The plane would have been consumed by the fire. It would have crashed earlier, not flown until it ran out of fuel. Okay? Right? It's just not... No. It's not an explanation. So... That to be something else. Everybody who's speculating fire is just... You know, right now, since they're just... You know, let's face it, we've had so much coverage of this fucking thing. They're putting so many people out there that are clueless about this. The other day I had CNN on for a little bit, which I normally don't turn on. I had it on the other day. And they had a 777 pilot on one end, and they had some moron that basically you could see who didn't know anything about aviation speculating about this. You could see the guy who's just rolling his eyes, and he's just saying, no. Whatever the other guy's saying, he's just saying,
hey, but no. I heard someone on CNN asked if maybe it got sucked into a black hole.
Oh, well, yeah. They
got or that, maybe that, there was something supernatural involved.
Yes, yes. That's certainly, you know, worth investigating, sure. Yes.
So, but the one thing we can do at this point, last week we spent some time talking about, hey, until they find this thing, everybody has to be prepared. What if this thing suddenly shows up on somebody's radar heading towards the major city?
That's been
conclusively ruled out at this point.
Yes, I think that's been conclusively ruled out at this point. That is not happening. No.
Which is a good thing.
Which is a good thing, yes. We would not want, you know, let's face it, I asked what the payload on a 777 the other day. I was talking to some people that do air cargo, said it's about 200,000 pounds.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, all right. So, yeah. I mean, think about 200,000 pounds of explosives, basically, what, freaking like, almost like a nuclear bomb, for God's sakes? If you wanted to pack it in that big, yeah, that would be quite an explosion.
Yep. Well, as we said, thankfully that's ruled out at this point. Although, you know, if any of the family members were holding out hope of that scenario because their people would still be alive,
I know.
I understand why that would be sad. But frankly, if that scenario was going on, they would have killed all the passengers anyway.
Yeah.
So, you know, sad situation all around. I'm not sure if we'll ever know exactly what really happened here. But anyway, as usual, like the safety stuff, you know, as you said, they'll probably start turning on the location stuff, even though this is a rare event. And, you know, it has actually got me thinking about sort of cost-benefit analysis. Almost no safety improvement you could make survives a flat-out normal cost-benefit analysis. Because, you know, it costs however many dollars to add that safety feature, but you know, you hardly ever have that happen. But this is how safety improvements happen. You know,
right.
You start out saying, oh, you know, every other time we do this, you know, somebody gets hurt, so let's add this safety feature. And then the next thing, you're doing something that only happens one out of every 20 times. And then you're talking about something that happens one out of 100. And then you're talking about things that only happen one out of every 10,000. And, you know, after a few decades of incremental improvements, you're making safety improvements that cost real money that only make a difference one out of millions or billions of times you use the product. But, you know, those are... you eventually eliminate, you know, it may only have happened one out of a million times, but let's say, you know, it's driving a car. Well, one out of a million times adds up to a hell of a lot of people dead over the course of a year, you know? Right. And so you make those safety improvements anyway. And I think, and you know, airline safety is even further, airline safety is already way safer than cars. So at this point, when you, when you make improvements, you're making improvements that only make a difference in extremely rare, extraordinary circumstances. But you know, incremental improvements add up over time. And you know, it's making, you know, again, if you did a straight-out cost-benefit analysis, you'd never make any of these improvements. But in the end, I think we're probably in a better world because we do. Because what happens is the cost gets distributed over the entire population that uses the device, or sometimes with taxes, the entire population of a country or the world. And so for each individual, it's an unnoticeable amount, and you're able to do these kinds of things that if anybody... you know, if there was a single upfront payment, you might never do. And you end up with a better world, even though, you know, I don't know. It's an interesting problem set there. But I don't mind, you know. If it's an extra, you know, 5 cents on an airline ticket, I'm never going to notice. But the next time something like this happens, even if it's 30 years down the road, we'll be in a better position because of it.
No, I agree. And, you know, everybody, think about it this way, okay? The 777 has been in service for around 20 years. I mean, there's been a grand total. This is the first time that, in a 777 that there's been, like, I mean, there's been 3 hull loss accidents in a 777 total in 20 years, which is basically the safest aircraft ever launched, okay? The first two, one was because some ice crystals forms on engines. Nobody died. The second one was this botched landing in San Francisco by a couple of pilots that apparently didn't know what they were doing last year. Okay, which basically was just a pilot error whole thing. And unfortunately, like a couple of people did die, okay, from that one. But this is the first time that one of these planes,
if I remember right, at least one of the people who died didn't actually
was run over by the emergency vehicles.
Yep.
Yeah. On the ground. So, yeah, I mean, it's this aircraft is incredibly safe. I to stress it, I mean, I've flown this aircraft like at least 100 times in my life. I mean, it's very safe. I felt very comfortable flying in it. And like I mentioned, I was once in an emergency situation in it, even still anyway, you know, and we managed to get back on the ground with what probably I described as the nicest landing ever done by any pilot on a plane I've ever been. So, usually the captains that are on these aircraft are the most experienced in the airlines themselves. I mean, usually this is like the top of the flight, you know, status at the place. So, I mean, you know, look, I mean, we're talking about how many thousand deaths we have in the U.S. I think about 30,000 traffic deaths every year. I mean, you know, despite whatever the heck happened with this thing, I know we want to make it as safe as possible, but, you know, I wouldn't hesitate on getting on one. No doubt about it. So,
well, there you go. Anyway. We're running late. Let's take a quick break and talk quickly about the landslide here in Washington State. We'll be back after this.
Ready for the test, Dracula? Classic celebrates the classic horror and science fiction films from the silent era through the 1960s, and retro TV horror from the 1950s to the 1970s. Visit creepyclassics.com for all your classic video needs. And when you buy something, tell Ron that the curmudgeons say hello.
Okay, we're back. So for those of you who haven't followed the news, and you know, at first, when I first heard about this, I heard about it locally from, I follow a Twitter account that follows the police scanner in my county here in Washington. And so I saw something when the emergency responders were first being called. And then I'm like, okay, this is going to be a local story. And then very soon it was like, okay, this is national news. Basically, there's a small town. Also, it's about 30 miles north of where I am here in Washington, about 55 miles north of Seattle. And it's in a sort of mountainous area. And there was a landslide. The slid down the side of the hill slash mountain slash whatever it is, and across a small river and onto the town on the other side of the river. And in the end, I guess it's about 50 houses and buildings completely covered by the mud from this landslide. There are reports of, at this point, as of the last update, about half an hour before we started recording this show, they've identified 24 bodies so far, but there's still approximately 100 people missing, or on the order of 100. They may have duplicate reports in there, so it may be a little bit less when all is said and done. They after the first night, they were hearing people calling for help. They're no longer hearing those people calling for help. So the chances of them finding any more people alive there are getting slimmer by the day. There have been similar circumstances other places in the world, earthquakes and such, where people have been found a while later. But from the description of this, it was a violent mudslide. Houses were destroyed completely. Cars were crushed. You know, in earthquake situations, they tend to sometimes find people in voids that are left underneath this stuff. It sounds fairly unlikely that there's going to be that going on here, unfortunately. A tragedy here, but, you know, Yvonne was mentioning when we were deciding what to listen to the show, there have also been reports here, hey, this exact hill had landslides in the past. One of the things
they called it landslide something. I mean, it had a name related to a landslide, and they kept giving warnings that this thing was a landslide, and people kept authorizing the construction of housing. There was a guy who had advised a warning that came back and was shocked that they said, you know, we just warned that this damn thing could slide on the town, and I see people authorizing more housing to be built. And so,
and I think one of the things that people have mentioned is that people felt a false sense of safety because of that river.
Mm-hmm.
Even if the hill, something happens with the hill, it'll be on the other side of the river.
It'll be on the other side of the river. Right.
But the geologist who had been involved there, you know, had said, look, you know, there have been slides there in the past. One of the biggest warning signs of future slides.
His previous slides.
This is an at-risk zone. And frankly, there are a lot of at-risk zones around of this sort. But as you said, people were building anyway. And I would bet you, regardless of what warnings were happening, that most of the people who actually bought the houses here weren't, you know, when they were buying the house, nobody was like, hey, look, and by the way, you should know that at any time, the mountain could fall down and squish this house. And right. And I bet you most of them had no idea that they were vulnerable.
Probably not.
Way. And you're right. Maybe some of the planners did, and maybe there'll be some. There will undoubtedly be lawsuits. There may, you know, who knows if there'll be anything criminal here. It's all a question of did anybody have a reasonable expectation that this was a serious possibility, and were negligent, or was it, you know, hey, look, even if a geologist warned that, hey, sometime in the next 1,000 years something may happen here. you know, do you take action against that? Because how far do you go on those lines? Because people have said the same thing. For instance, here in the Seattle area, there's a whole section of downtown Seattle that is built on landfill that people know if there's a major earthquake, the whole thing's going into the sea. Basically, the entire Seattle waterfront potentially goes into the ocean. We've got, they're rebuilding the viaduct.
That's not very smart.
They're rebuilding the viaduct here, which is an elevated highway downtown Seattle, because they know, they've done a variety of tests that say if there's a major earthquake, that thing's coming down too. There's a major bridge that if there's a major earthquake, the 520 bridge here, if there's a major earthquake, that thing falls over too and falls into the lake. So there are a lot of there's a lot of areas here where we know there's vulnerability. Do we say, you know, hey, we have to evacuate that whole part of the city and not allow anybody to be there? Similarly speaking, people have said the same thing about, well, frankly, your whole state. The whole state of Florida is incredibly vulnerable to hurricanes. You know,
okay, that's just a listen.
No, look, no, no,
you
no,
could,
no,
you
no.
Could, yeah, a bunch of bullshit. You could protect yourself against hurricanes. It's a lot more. Yeah, I mean, it's a lot easier to protect against the damn hurricane than it is to protect against frickin' earthquake.
No, look, there's all of these various types of natural disasters. I was going to go on to Tornado Alley in the Midwest.
Right. Where the fuck do we live?
Well, this is the whole thing. Every place is vulnerable to something. Do you want to legislate and say, you know, if you're in a risk zone, you can't build? Maybe. I don't know. We're talking about the whole safety things again.
It depends. Listen, it depends on everything and, like, what risk. Look,
what for risk example. Is acceptable?
Exactly. Right. Okay.
And so, this and I don't know. Like, for instance, use, in this, you know, I don't know. For instance, in this particular case,
exactly.
You know, what was the risk here? Was it, were people saying that sometime in the next 20 years, it's inevitable that this was going to happen? This
actually
landslide.
Said in less than 10, they said in less than 10. Actually, what I was reading.
Okay.
Yeah, it was extremely high risk. I mean, it was like, you know, it wasn't the low risk. It had happened before. They said it was going to happen again. They kept saying, listen, guys, this is not a joke. It's going to happen again. And, well, it did. Now, you know, like everything, there's certain risks you can prepare for. There's certain risks you can't. Okay, all right? You know, I mean, if there's a 5,000-pound, you know, weight above your head, attached to a very thin cable that, you know, is going to snap at some point. Okay. You know, you can move away from under the damn thing. Right. Okay. You know, but
you think,
I mean, yeah, I mean, but that's my point, because this is basically the case with this. I mean, you're talking about this entire area. This is going to slide down on you at any second. All right. So you could move. Now you're talking about an earthquake. I mean, shit. The fault line, basically, what? We evacuate the entire, how many sections of the United States because of possibility of earthquakes? I mean, no. So what you do is, like, you build, you know, you scout areas that are safer. You use the right construction methods. And basically, you do what you can to make sure that that you can do that. That's about as best as you can do. But you certainly can't just evacuate an entire, you know, Western United States because there's a risk of earthquake. And Colombia and Mexico and Puerto Rico, and I could just go on and on and on.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. Washington, D.C. had an earthquake last year.
That's right. And so did Illinois a couple of years ago, too.
Yeah. I mean, and you're right. There's a lot that can be done there in terms of safety standards for building and stuff like that. Like, even the San Francisco quake of, in the 80s, whenever that was, they've talked about the standards for the building that has happened since then in San Francisco are so much stronger and so much more able. And in Japan as well, they've done immense improvements in technology in terms of earthquake resistance. So there's all kinds of stuff that can be done. And I mean, who knows? You could have even done an engineering effort in this town to build something that, you know, to shore up the hill or make stronger houses or something. Yeah, from what I've heard, that would have been an immense effort to do anything here. So it probably would have been easier just to move everybody out. But you know, there are technological solutions to these, but it all comes down to and it ties into what we were talking about planes last time. It comes into looking at risk reward, cost benefit, and deciding when you are going to do things like say to people, you can't live here, or say to people, you can't live here unless you build to these really expensive standards, or, you know, take on public money to do engineering efforts to mitigate risk or whatever. When do you decide to do those things and when do you not? Is, you know, okay, if this really was like this will happen, this will inevitably happen and it'll happen sometimes in the next 10 years, then maybe there is a negligence issue at stake here that somebody should have done something or said something prior to the landslide happening. But what if it was, you know, there's a 1% chance of it happening sometime in the next 100 years? Then what?
I don't know.
Yeah, where do you draw the line for those kinds of decisions?
At some point, you got to draw one. I don't, you know, that's what I say. I mean, there's certain risk. There's people better at measuring it than I am. Okay, but at some point, you got to say this is too risky. No way. Okay.
And, well, even then, do you have sort of do you require that the risk be disclosed, but still let people take the risk if they want to? Or do you actually buy the area and say this is a protected area, nobody's allowed in here?
No, you can allow them to, but let's face it. I mean, they're going to be have issues.
Well,
I mean,
and in this particular case,
and other things. And,
yeah, and in this particular case, like I said, I would bet you anything that of the people who were killed by this, mm-hmm. you know, most if not all of them had no idea of the risk they were under. Some of them
that's a disclosure issue.
And also, for that matter, some of the people killed were just driving by on the road. They didn't even live there. They were just driving by.
Right. Well, it's a shame, unfortunately, you know.
And yeah, and I've heard people saying, you know, like I said, when I first heard about this, I'm like, oh, it's a landslide. There, a few, maybe a couple people were killed, and but the scale is much bigger. And I was listening to someone talking about it this afternoon that this looks like, depending on how it ends up, this could easily be the worst natural disaster that this state has ever seen.
Well,
you know, so. I really feel for those people. Like I've seen some of the, some of the people talking, some of the survivors. That the one picture hit me more. I retweeted it the other day. It was a 4-year-old who had been pulled out and was alive, was going to be fine, but they were being pulled out and evacuated by a helicopter. And I'm like, you know, my kid's 4. You know, it really hits you. You know. And, you know, you think about all these people, and I heard someone today saying, I at least hope it was quick, because, you know, if on the one hand, it may have been quick for some of these people where their houses were destroyed in 1 second, but also there were people calling for help that they weren't able to get to, you know, and it's like, that's just awful, you know?
Yeah, so, all right. Okay, well.
Once again, we end the show on a cheery note.
Oh, yeah, great.
Thanks, everybody, for listening to Curmudgeon's Corner once again. If you have any questions, comments, or thoughts, you know where to get us. Abelsmay at abelsmay.com for me, or Abelsmay on Twitter. I am Bo on Twitter. We love hearing from you. And we'll talk to you again next week. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.